and all the leading characters in history that are going to be utilized in connection with this lesson will have appropriate names. So that's even being overruled, whether man realizes it or not. And so these names are significant, especially when they be given their true interpretation and the slant given on it. And they'll make a very forceful demonstration, which we think will be in part visually pictured as part of history. We used to have a time, March of Time, years ago, when I was a young fellow, that they used to show. All right, there's Tyre, situate in the seas, ending up with desolation. And here in the New Testament, you have the same thing in principle, the papal system, made rich by the wealth of all the nations brought to her. And that when she goes down, the others mourn her loss. The certain element mourns her loss, those more immediately attached to her. So we go back to Revelation now.
Can I just something you said that it illustrates three things? Satan,
the papacy, the Catholic Church, and the city itself. It's the lesson is Tyre, a natural application. And this city is spoken of in many different chapters and in different books, of which we've only taken a very small part. But we took that part because it had to do with the ship in the midst of the seas, and yet it's a port at the entry of the sea. So it describes it two ways in this chapter, as a boat, and then in the same picture it speaks of it situated at the entry to the sea, as a port. And in Revelation, it just speaks of it as a maritime power, without pinpointing its location, except that it's identified with the seas.
Brother Frank?
Yes.
I noticed that verse 30 there in Ezekiel says about the dust on their heads, and I remember we discussed that at the last study. We had read that verse, and we wondered why they were going to have dust on their heads. That's over there in the verse 19 of the Revelation chapter.
Yes.
The dust on their heads.
Yeah.
Same expression.
In connection with the yeah. Then it mentions that every shipman, now we're back in Revelation 17 chapter, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company that is in ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? And they did cast dust on their heads, and so forth. Then it ends up, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. Now we spoke on that, didn't we, in the previous lesson? On the 1 hour. Yeah, the suddenness of it and why and what hour this was. And so we don't want to be repetitious here. So maybe we could start with the 21st then.
What were the shipmasters there in 17?
Says, and every shipmaster and all the company in ships and sailors and as many trade stood afar after in connection with her. Shipmaster generally is a what?
Captain.
A captain. Now in this verse it's not picturing it as a boat but as a city made rich by the boats from other nations coming into her port. And all those that are coming, whether they're the shipmaster or the tradesmen or the merchants or the merchandise, are all affected in connection with her destruction. See, it says every shipmaster and all the company in the ships. Now, this would be travelers, company in the ships, and the sailors.
Could the shipmasters be even the big shipping companies?
Oh, in the figuratively, in the analogy, it would be any of the businessmen, any of leading men of business and finance, identified with the papal system in one way or another. Not necessarily just finance either, but any people of prestige and power, of the laity, that deal with her, that they will be involved in connection with the forsaking of the system. If their own fortune will be affected. These would be the captains then, the shipmaster would be the captain on the boat. The sailor would be the ones underneath their authority, and those of the company in the ships would be the travelers and also the rowers, who are slaves. They're pictured here too, in another part, I think, another verse. And they're the ones that were prisoners and political outcasts, and usually they died in the chains rowing these boats. They just used them as fuel. Just whipped them to death and fed them, and if they were unusually hardy, maybe someday some of them might escape or get free if somebody took a fancy to them. But the chances were very slim indeed. And if they persons who are sadistic, they could take it out on them, and then if they died, well, when they get to the next port, they can buy new fuel to row the boats. So that's the human life didn't mean very much. And I mentioned about the souls of men too there, the slave traffic that's involved in connection with this system. Now these shipmasters too would be prominent laymen primarily, but on the other hand, even in the system you have the different class. You have the leaders, you have the cardinals, the bishops, the priests, and who are the and the eunuchs. The eunuchs would be the nuns and the monks. I'm just pinpointing a little stronger, but they bring out the principle of it, who have dedicated their lives. You have a celibate priesthood. And then you have the nuns who weren't allowed to marry. See, so the principle carries right there, that they would be all affected too. So that when the institution would go down, all these involved in the institution too. So whether you take this from the standpoint of those outside the institution, but really a part of it, but outside in connection with it when it's going down, they will be involved anyway. They will be very materially affected. Figuratively affected in connection with his downfall. Some will try to go in hiding and try to hide their profession, but they will be ferreted out like they were in the French Revolution. It's not a very pleasant picture, and we're glad that we don't have anything to do with this, that it's just the law of retribution that does it. This has been done to others, and it's reap their own reward. Certainly we don't encourage this in ourselves. It's just that the Bible predicts that it will go down, and it will go down with violence. And no matter how well intentioned some are, the practices were not of the Lord. They're frowned on. The worldly church. But anyway, these individuals, whether you view it from the standpoint of just the institution going down and those that were in the institution and had dealings with it, from the standpoint of the clergy and so forth being involved, or whether you view it that they are the part that goes down first and that these others stand apart, which is my thought, that these others are more of the laity or others who are traffic with the system in a less direct way. They are not in it in the sense of being religious orders themselves, but yet they have business ties and other ties related through their affiliation with the system in another capacity. But in any event, they all are involved. And the reason they're crying is not only because of the city going down, that they realize that they are going to be affected themselves. We cast dust on their heads and cried. Did we go into that? We did not just listen.
Well, the mighty angels took us.
Did we take that? Should we go into that or not?
We have the dust on the head as representing the sackcloth and ashes.
Yeah. Now, supposing you're a woman and you have an expensive coiffure and all sorts of ornamentation on your hair. And then in your bereavement and all, you cast the dirt on your head. That would be kind of a real humiliation, wouldn't it? Or whether you shaved all your hair off and made yourself bald, which is also done. The men usually did that. But in the Bible, the women do too on occasion. It would be an outward sign of the inward grief of the individual that's involved. And it would have to be sorrow. For somebody to do these things, it would have to be the real thing, because their vanity would forbid them to just do a mock demonstration of weeping. See, that doesn't cost much. See, you can be very sorrowful, long face, and be very sympathetic, but it may not be very deep. And it wears very often. But if you cut all your hair off, or you must just wrench your clothes, your good clothes, and rend them, well, then that could really cost something, and you wouldn't do it. So it would really show, it would be outwardly showing how vain these things really are in the final analysis. When it comes to things that matter, the real vital issues of life, the loss of one that's very dear to one in a very close sense, then these things don't mean much, do they? I mean, they feel, well, what good are they without the companionship of such and such a party, or for some other reason, whatever the reasons might be. So it's a real demonstration here. So here, this sorrow, whether it's fear or anguish or love, whatever the emotion is, this is an intense manifestation. It's not an ordinary thing that's pictured here. And sackcloth too. You know, take the women, that would be very hard for them, because generally, they are thinking of their form in their body, especially if they have a physique. They like to get their garments tailored to show to advantage the animal aspect, to attract the opposite sex, or to the admiration of even other women. But what does it really amount to? I mean, in the final analysis. But you see, this in grief, in moments of real seriousness, to demonstrate this, they put a sackcloth on, just a bag, because to show that these things are very superficial, and while they may mean a lot to us in this life, what are they in the long run picture? Anybody, for instance, now take with us as Bible students, anybody who makes their calling and election sure, for the rest of eternity will be the most attractive a specimen they can imagine, of beauty in every way, mentally, morally, spiritually, whatever body they have, they will be everything. So what is this life? It's only a little tiny short time measured against that. So if it meant the sacrifice of these things in order to attain the other, why, they would be nothing, like Paul says, it'd be just like dung. What is it? What is all these things in life? They're nothing. So here, when in connection with this grief, wearing of the sackcloth, you can imagine if you had a burlap bag and took your clothes, wrench your clothes, and then took them and put in their place an old dilapidated grain bag, or potato bag, or whatever it is, and went around with dust on your ashes, on your dust on your ashes, dust on your head, and then. And wailing and beating your chest with sorrow. Well, anybody look, they say, well, they would really begin to cry, the neighbors. They would see that the grief there is so real that they would be very sympathetic just beholding the spectacle. So these things are very forceful if they're properly appreciated, and especially if we lived in that day and saw a few of these things as they were done, we'd appreciate it more. But today, our emotions and our mannerisms and everything are very artificial, our life today. Now we come to the 21st. Can we come to that now? This is where the lesson is supposed to start tonight, I think. rejoice over her, thou. Oh no, we had this.
We were supposed to start the 19th chapter tonight.
We were?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Oh,
but we were doing it. We were doing it for Charles's benefit.
Yeah.
Well, for the tape.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, then we'll go hurriedly. 20th verse. Is that? Should we cover that one then? 20th. Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. Now we spoke on the apostles. That's quite apparent there, that the 12 apostles would be very happy to see that the honor, that the honors of the kingdom would be exposed as being particularly appropriate to Christ and to his own apostles rather than to a false church and false apostles. Apostolic succession. There's been all down the age this continuity in both the Roman and the Anglican church. The succession of apostles, see, they've been teaching that. Instead of having 12 apostles, it says, thou hast found them to be, that say they are apostles and are not, or something, or found them to be liars. In Revelation it mentions that. Well, that's what's been true. I mean, they've taken credit where the credit was unmerited. And so when the true picture is seen, in, as it really is and should be, well, then there'll be great rejoicing. Rejoice over her, thou heaven. Now you see, with this kind of sorrow, though, it's the law of retribution. And the sorrow, it says the blood of prophets was in her, originally, that she was filled with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And I'll mention two different classes there in the earlier part of this chapter. So if she cries a little, I mean, it's from the standpoint, from the overall picture, it's really merited from God's standpoint. That's why he's saying, forsake her, and come out of her, that you don't become partakers of her, not only the sins, but of the plagues too. Now, the prophets, who are these prophets, holy apostles and prophets, who are to rejoice over her?
Prophets of the New Testament.
Would be, we would feel probably primarily the prophets of the New Testament. Just like there were prophets in the Old Testament, Moses and various ones, so in the New Testament there were seven of them. Remember the seven stars of Revelation. And that the apostles are styled as prophets. And they would be very happy to see the God's kingdom established and the true church exalted and Jesus properly venerated and honored. God hath avenged you on her. It's suggested too that these had been done a dishonor. God hath avenged you on her, as though they had taken the honors that belonged to the apostles and these prophets to themselves. They were the apostles, and their great ones were the prophets, but actually they were not the true ones. And so when the picture is finally seen in the final outcome, when the proper ones are identified, they'll be very happy to know that the public will be made aware of who the true church was, and primarily its principal officers, as well as its chief, our Lord Jesus himself. Now the 21st verse, did we have that on the tape? Is that on the tape? The great millstone? All right, we'll take it. A mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, and he cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city, Babylon, be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. Now, do you ever see a millstone around? Some of them are pretty large. Tremendous stones, and generally they have this hole in the center. And they're fastened to a stake-like arrangement, and then sometimes with cogwheels too. There are different kinds, different blades. And the grain is ground between an upper and lower stone. The lower stone is stationary, the upper stone is rotates. And it can be done by hand or by animals. Some of them, the big ones, are done by animals or oxen who pull the stone around. And the grain is underneath, and it's ground. And the chaff is broken, the husk of the grain. And then the wind and other methods are used to fan out and have only the wheat germ, the more solid material, left behind. But that grain, that coarse material, has to be ground. Now here we see this vision. Let's just think of it from a natural standpoint. When you look at a big millstone, you think of what first? When you look at it, you're impressed with what?
The weight,
generally. I mean, you know it's a big stone, its size and its weight. And so the Lord is going to deal with this system, which is quite an influential and quite a powerful system. And it's just like, as an individual, if you were to take that stone up and throw it in the sea, you'd think, well, that'd be pretty hopeless, wouldn't it? I mean, you wouldn't even be able to lift the stone up. But to think of somebody picking it up and throwing it down with power, force, well, you think they'd have to be really mighty to do that. They'd have to be a Hercules. And so it says here that this Herculean angel, a mighty angel, see, we read these words, we don't think much on it, do we? I mean, we just read mighty angels and go right on, and we don't get the power of the vision, and we forget it. And you ask us a year later about it, we don't know any details about it, primarily because we haven't a sufficiency of interest to just to sit down and listen to what the Lord says. Just to listen to Him. You know, some people, you try to tell them something, they're already talking before you've got the first word out of your mouth, and they can't absorb much that way. You really can't. And you can always talk later. There's plenty of opportunity. I mean, there's 12 hours a day. You can get your words in later, another time. And so here we find this. Here's the stone that's impressive with its weight and size. And in this vision, a mighty angel picks this stone up and he hurls it violently down into the sea. And then you say, well, what in the world did he do that for? Now, when he does that, what would be the next thing you would probably witness? You'd be impressed with the strength of the angel who could lift that stone. You're impressed with the size of the stone. That's the first thing. You're impressed with the angel who has the power to lift that stone. And then what's the next thing you're impressed with? The splash. The big splash. And that's what this chapter is describing, that all that with this city being destroyed in 1 hour, the repercussion is terrific. Everybody's involved with this when it goes down. All these merchants and ones of traffic, they're all involved, and so when it goes, there is figuratively a big splash. And so we even use that in journalistic language to mean that you make quite an impression and a public display in some manner, whatever it happens to be talking about. And it's cast. And not only is the big splash, but the weight and the power of that stone and the hitting of there's power there in connection with that splash too, as well as a demonstrative spray involved. Thus with violence shall that great city, Babylon, be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. Now we come to an interesting verse, the 22nd, the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeteers shall be heard no more at all in thee, and no craftsman of whatever soever craft he be shall be found any more in thee, and the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more in thee, and the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee, for thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. All right, now we go back and just consider briefly a few of them. First, you'll notice the grouping is that of music, those playing music. Now, what's the voice of Harker's in this particular picture? Sometimes you can play the harp on the other side of the veil, but this is on
those who are happy in the nominal.
Yeah, this is those in the happy in the nominal system, that, and they are playing the Bible in their own way. They're making music, and that's delighting them. But it's a mixed music we find from certain other standpoints. And we think in taking it just now, we took it in the natural standpoint before, that we have in the churches, you have the
workers.
Yes, you have the workers, you have the choirs, you have the organist, and you have the vestments, and even the incantation of the, what is it, the litany and other things that are involved that are done in a musical tone, with incense being swung on censers, Dominus Vobiscum, and all the ceremony, and which pleases many. They're very pleased with this. It's very relaxing and entertaining in their way. And here it tells that all this sound will cease, but of course it's primarily figurative. That it's the figurative ones that are happy, as Sister mentioned, in her, and voice that appreciation. And it mentions no craftsman of whatsoever craft he shall be found any more in thee. Well, what kind of craftsmen are there?
All the images they have, for one thing. And the rosaries, somebody's going to make all these.
That's right, there's the statuary.
Fancy candlesticks, yeah. Candelabra.
Right.
They go in for big show there.
And of course, when these things are done away with, well, then there's no more employment.
And the gowns that these.
Ornamented, with gold and all these.
Ermine trimmed, is it, robes?
Yes, they have ermine trimmed robes.
What they have.
And velvet and all kinds of very fancy materials that we don't even know about in this country because they're made in foreign lands. Very limited market to them, but it's a very lucrative one to those that are involved and have the inside contracts. And then there's the temples too. The making of all these structures. I mean, you take some of these cities, these nations that are poverty-stricken nations, and they'll have these great cathedrals. I mean, we meet in homes or in some public building, and that's really, and some of them, they're pathetic, the sight of them, but they serve the purpose, because the main thing is not the building, it's the God's word is the main thing, and the information we get, and the worship and the service. But when you consider in these lands and with this poverty, and then have these great structures, you can see they're like leeches in the earth. I remember going to Canada alone. This is no backward country here. And you're going up there, and you go out in these farmlands off the side, and you go in these little towns with little narrow roads, and you see in the great distance in these flat and the flat plain of Canada, you see way in the difference these steeples of a great, what we would call a cathedral, and in a little town, they have to, and then of course everything goes with it. When you go inside, it's not an empty cathedral. I mean, they have every nook and cranny filled with all kinds of fancy, not only statuary and candles and incense and paintings and art, but also wood, woods and glass, stained glass and so on. So it. Here, when it says no craftsman, you could see that just with the simple ceasing of that form of worship would involve many people with crafts. Now it says the sound of a millstone shall be heard in the wall. Well, what's the sound of a millstone?
We had that
the
last
night.
Yeah.
The food, spiritual food. of course, sometimes it has a grinding noise, too. I mean, it really is a monotonous, grinding of this material that's churned out, and it's as flat and as can be, but it's the food that's given under these conditions. And that's, it's likened, this system is likened to being thrown down primarily because of this responsibility as the preparer of food. It's because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication. I mean, this is just one of the aspects. It's condemned for falsely teaching the Lord's word. They claim to be the teacher. They are the custodian. Nobody else is allowed to teach or preach. You have to be taught by them, and the church is taught of as being the custodian of the truth. But instead of giving the truth, they keep it, and it's a worldly philosophy that goes out, and their people know very little of the Bible down through history. Very, very little. And they only put a few platitudes in with the message that came out. Now, the light of a candle, what is the light of a candle? Remember in the book of Revelation, where did we hear this before?
We mentioned how the Lord walked between the candlesticks, isn't it?
Right. And one of the messages to the churches said what? If such and such a thing wasn't done, I will come in and do Jesus speaking.
Candlestick.
Yeah, remove that candlestick from its place. Well, what is the candlestick? I mean, in this, what is the candlestick?
The truth, the light.
The light of truth. Yeah. Now, sometimes the Lord's people are spoken of as candles, which should be not hid under a bushel, but be put on a hill. But this is speaking of a more important one, not just, not all these little ones. Little tapers, but this is the one candle, and that would mean then, not only is it the truth,
source of
truth. Yes, it's involved there. It's from but it's another picture. What's the sword a picture of? A scepter a picture of?
Rulership.
Well, yes, rulership. It's more of a prerogative rather than the actual usage of it. I mean. You might have a symbolic sword or scepter, but you don't use that to hit somebody with. But it's an ornamentation. This particular type, it's a single one. It's not like an individual one which you'd use in battle. Therefore, that sword or that whatever it be, was an insignia of a power or right you have. Now, when you have the candle to take that candlestick away, it's not only the truth and the Bible, but it's more than that even. It's the privilege of dispensing the light. It says, like Babylon hath been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. So this candle is the privilege of representing God would be removed. Well, of course, if the privilege is removed, then would the candle would go and the light would go and everything go indirectly. I mean, that's all a part of it. But it was shows that it was an unfaithful discharge of the duty. And that's what it said in the Revelation, the message to the church, that if they didn't amend their ways, this would be removed from them and they would suffer. In many ways, the light would go too. That would be understandable.
Is this a little similar to the darkening of the sun?
Yes, yes. It depends which book you're referring to, but because there's about three or four places, but yes, it's tied in with one of them, definitely. Now, here's another one. The voice of the bridegroom and the bride. Now, the bridegroom is who?
Jesus.
And the bride, of course, is the church. But it speaks of it, bride and bridegroom. Now, is the church the bride in the present age? In the gospel age, is the church the bride? It's an espousal. Therefore, when this is worded this way, it suggests that when this narration is given in the vision, it's suggesting what?
Church is gone.
It's gone. It's over. The picture's over. And it's telling about it has fallen, and it shows that the church, the true church, will be gone when Babylon falls. And Brother Russell says that one of the evidence Satan is bound is the binding of the church. That's one. Or another, using another illustration, we know the door is shut when the church falls. That's another. Not only the time of trouble, but the fall of the church. And this is the scripture. The voice of the bride is the same before and after marriage. She may be happier, but it's the same voice. In other words, I mean, you get a person in natural life, I mean, they're the same. They're single, and they talk with such and such a voice, and then they're married, and they have that voice still. And so here, it's saying that the voice of the bride and bridegroom now, which was formerly heard in her, not as the bride, or as the bridegroom, but the same personality that who is now the bride and bridegroom, who were back there at one time had voiced themselves in this, would no longer be heard. So it helps give this picture a time focus. It gives you a little standpoint in which you're viewing this vision, and that's from the standpoint of its completion. Another thing. Is the voice of the bridegroom heard now in Babylon?
I like freaking to wonder that. I mean, when the bride ever had been married.
Well, she hasn't fallen yet, has she?
She hasn't fallen yet. Sure, it's heard. It says, come out of her, my people. Now, how could you hear the bridegroom's voice? So you see, many have given this thought that the voice of the bride and bridegroom, that ceased back in 1878. Well, I believe that chronologically the monomial system was cast out of the Lord's mouth back there as being the sole distributor of the truth. Not that they had no truth, but that part of it. But this picture, it has nothing. It's not even allowed to represent the truth. It's allowed to represent the truth today. The Catholic Church still thinks it's the church. It still tells the people. It's still shining as a candle, misrepresenting one, and it's taking all these honors to itself. But in this vision, it's not, because it's gone. It's no longer, and it's complete. So this is the finality picture, and some of these other pictures are the ones we're confusing with this one. So it has to be careful with the con. So I feel that in this case, the emphasis is in connection with its real destruction, not just merely being cast off in favor. And the Lord's voice is heard in Babylon. Anybody who hears, come out of her, my people, must have been in her and must have heard that voice while they were in there. And it's not referring to him after the marriage. Of course, nobody's going to hear after the marriage the voice in there, because the system doesn't exist. But the voice of our master and of the church is heard in the nominal system prior to its destruction. And just as to what the time comes when the last member is crystallized in character, I still think that's future. But there will be a point of time where there will be a last member. And from that time on, there will be no more the voice heard. And that's just a little bit before the fall, her downfall. And but still, it's future.
The voice of the bridegroom is yet heard there.
It's yet heard there, that's right. And of the bride.
Brother Frank, in this life, we can't distinguish between the bride and the bridesmaids either.
No.
We shouldn't.
Not of the bride. The bride?
Bride?
Is, no.
Yeah.
How could it be if it's being as an espoused virgin?
No, but I'm trying to say that the espoused virgin has the same voice before her marriage as after it. And this picture is showing that the system is destroyed. And it says, no more is heard in there. Well, of course there's no more is heard. It's destroyed. But it implies that the voice was heard in her before. And so was the harpers and the musicians and the trumpeteers and the craftsmen, and so all kinds of noise going on, and light and display and activity. There was a lot of activity there. And now nothing, because of the, therefore the voice of the all these musicians and all is still heard. The voice of the bride is still heard in her. The bride class. They're told to come out, but that time that they come out is when they reach the age of discretion, spiritually speaking. They're not held accountable, the spirit begotten in Babylon, until they develop up to a certain level. It's like a baby. When a baby is born, and it's a little tiny thing, you don't expect that baby to do, to act like an adult and reason with you. But after that baby has grown a little while and grows up into a little lad, you expect that it begins to learn a little instruction. And so it's not until these spiritual begotten ones, who are babies to start with, when they grow up a little bit, they mature a little, and they're still children, then they get the invitation, come out of her, my people, that you be so. They've come to the age of discretion from the Lord's standpoint. Then they come out. And that, but before that, they were his people too, because when they're babies, they're his. Because to be spirit begotten, we all start as babies, whether we like it or not. And no matter how much truth we had, we might have been with in a family that was thoroughly consecrated and had a great, and we come in, we're still babies, because it's not the head knowledge. With being an infant in the Lord's sight has to do with character development and standing for truth and certain principles. That all is a part of it. And so those who don't have the knowledge are babies, and those that have the knowledge are babies. But after experience comes, you use discretion between that which is right and wrong along certain lines with deeper doctrines. And that's another thing. Those that are of age to begin to discriminate or discern between. And that's a different type of knowledge. That's not book knowledge. That's things in life where you have... It's one thing, you could read a lot and know a lot, but when it comes to a certain crisis, you might be a coward. You might be a downright coward. And not even stand up for the Lord on certain things. So what are you? You are a babe. You're a weakling. You're nothing. So the knowledge... But if you have this knowledge and use it to stand up for the Lord in connection with certain issue, or for that which is right, even though you may not be an elder. So you may lose your eldership by speaking up. You know, because it'll create friction or certain misunderstanding. If it's a duty that has to be done, that takes courage. Now, we all fall down. I mean, I'm not thinking I'm a Hercules or anything, but I mean, we all are in this battle, and you don't have to be an elder, you don't have to be a deacon, you can be anybody. There are times in our life we have to make these decisions, and it's that shows whether you're a man or a woman. That is from the standpoint of mature in the Lord's sight. And that takes both knowledge and character to put into practice certain things you stand for. And that's different. So we can start out with a lot of knowledge and think look, we know this, and what do they know? Well, they don't know anything. Why, we don't even know they're even spirit begotten, because they're not like us, you see. But who are we? You see, it takes this time, and then the Lord does this discerning and this testing, and it'll be made revealed in due time who are the ones who have really been responding under the Lord's tutelorship.
Brother Frank.
Yes?
In this connection with this 23rd verse, it's very important. It's in the third volume, page 181. Statement is made about she is spewed out of the Lord's mouth. Neither the voice of the bridegroom nor the bride shall be heard in her anymore forever. And upon this, many conclude that there are no spirit begotten. On the basis of this statement in the third volume,
if that were true, then that instead of the general call ceasing in 1881, it would have had to cease before 1881, because this is applied for 1878. Three years earlier. I mean, you have to use your reasoning powers. I mean, how can you hear the voice come out of my people? Who's doing that talking? It's the Lord. Even though a human instrumentality, whether it's Brother Russell or anybody else, it's the Lord that's doing the calling through a human agency to come out.
So, Frank,
yeah.
this thought of no longer being the torchbearer of truth, that would apply to 1878.
From the Lord's standpoint.
Yes.
You see, that's the whole thing. We're viewing things from this standpoint. The Lord no longer recognizes Babylon as the candle, or that he is approvingly in any way related to it. But the world doesn't know it. She still is the candle from the standpoint of the world, and she still has the Lord's people in there. How can there be a harvest? This harvest is coming out of the system before the time of trouble. They're called out before the time of trouble, lest they have participate in a later flight in the winter. Now the Lord's voice, instead of being related more in the system, is outside the system, calling into it. But the voice is heard. It's heard in the system. And they're his people while they're in the system. He doesn't call people out without any discernment. He calls them out when they can understand the call. That's what I'm saying. When an infant, you don't call an infant out of the nominal system immediately. You may think they're infant because they don't know certain doctrines we know. They may not know about the covenant or the presence, and we may classify. But that isn't the point. It's their consecration to the Lord from certain standpoints. They recognize their sinner. They made a consecration to the Lord. They're really sincere in what they have had some experience. Then as they develop, they find the crib is too small, and if they are now really desirous, they'll respond, come out.
This is not just Catholic yeah. Church, but all nominal
systems. Well, it's primarily the Protestant that the Spirit begotten are in. See, this Babylon involves all of them, actually, in the final analysis. They're all involved in this picture. But she's the primary one. Another thing, when the call was made to Babylon back in ancient times by Jeremiah, when the Jews were called out of Babylon, Babylon hadn't fallen. They said, Babylon has fallen, come out of her. But Babylon hadn't fallen. But from God's standpoint, its doom was irrevocable and the die was cast. Before that, technically, they had the possibility of changing. Technically, they had, up until 1878. We would have healed Babylon, but she would not have been healed. But there was a time that the Lord was patient, like with Israel, and they could have done so. If they responded, they had that technical right. Until the time element ceased, when it was no longer, and the die was irrevocably cast, then it says Babylon has fallen, because when 1878 came, then came the point of time beyond which there's going to be no retrieving. There's no possibility now. Just like with Satan, he had an opportunity too. His die was cast in the Garden of Gethsemane. He had an opportunity to repent, Satan, even with all his deeds, and that's why Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, I beheld Satan, fall from heaven. He's referring from the standpoint, not his initial degradation to the planet, but by the act of crucifying Jesus, he now had reached the point where retreat was an impossibility. He was now definitely beyond the pale of salvation. And that's the point of time there. Here, the 1878 is the point of time where it'll never be. And so now the Lord's people are told, come out of her, because it's not going to be healed. That's the reason for coming out. Any hope of the other would be fruitless. And so just as in natural Babylon, it was decried as though it were destroyed and cast into the sea, the thought is, they were informed that this definitely was going to happen, therefore respond. And so here it is, the same thing. In 1878, the message came, a knock at the door, And it said not only about the Lord's presence, but to buy this eye salve and do these things, this, thus, and thus, because in there, where you are, you're not going to get the blessing unless you come out. And if you do, if you open this door, and you come out to me, see, then you get this blessing. But not that there are no spirit begotten ones there. I mean, that... And of course, Brother Russell never had the thought that there are no spirit begotten ones there. All through his writings, he's consistent on that point, definitely. In her was found the blood of prophets, saints, and all that were slain upon the earth. That's a pretty broad condemnation. That doesn't mean that before her formation, she couldn't have destroyed prophets. But ever since her inception, ever since the formation of this, the responsibility for the spiritual death, whether it been literal, like the Inquisition, or whether it was done by being ostracized, from that time on, that's been the whole history of the papal and Protestant systems in the past. Primarily the papal. They are responsible for it.
Frank, I notice those last few verses keep repeating no sound no more at all.
No, that's right.
Different things sound no more
at all.
No,
at all, that's right.
Is that to emphasize not even the least little
bit? That's right. That's the point that we're trying to make. The other is theoretical. The other rejection, the Lord rejects. And when he once rejects, you might as well be as good as dead, as far as the finality is concerned. But you may live on for 10, 20 years. See? But from his standpoint, the die is cast. But this is not emphasizing that part. This is emphasizing from the standpoint of those that are afar off and they see that it's happened. It's not just God seeing it. The merchants are standing afar off and they see it. And they realize what's happened. And that has not happened. So there are two falls of Babylon. The one from favor and grace, and the other the actual fall. The complete. Well, you know, this is a pretty strong message, and you can see some people, they would wonder, they'd say, well, why all this hard line? They would think it's kind of a waste of words, and it's like listening to a party, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and all, and they view the Lord's word in that same way. Well, this, they don't see anything especially happening or any significant, and it goes right over their head. But anybody who is seriously inquiring of the Lord, and they meet that, and knowing what God stands for, they listen to this. Because the one who is speaking in strong terms is not just an ordinary man. Because we are prone to exaggerate. And especially if we're emotionally agitated, we say things beyond their true proportion. But this is God's message, whether it's through Christ or any other announcement. And so when he's speaking in this strong way, it's worthy of attention. But you see, many, when we're sleepy, students, and I'm not speaking in the Bible study, I'm speaking down through history, that when we're sleepy, Christian, and we read this, it shows our condition, not the Lord's, because this shows that when it happens, it's going to be really, like it says, the ears will tingle when it happens. It'll be the report is going to be, that's how powerful it's going to be. Just to hear it, we hear of certain violent crimes, sexual crimes or different things or dope addictions, and sometimes they're so bad for the rest of that day. That's all you got in your mind. The horror of that particular experience. Your ears are tingled, so to speak, with the forcefulness of just the narration of it, let alone seeing it. Those who see it, of course, would probably, if they were soft-hearted, they would see it for the rest of their life. They would be scarred with the experience for life.